Hello, welcome to the Transmedia Podcast. Today we're going to share with you the talk that Emmett Fury gave for Conductor Conference 2015. He talks about engaging audiences across multiple platforms and social media storytelling. Emmett is a transmedia producer, and he has worked in the web series The New Adventures of Peter and Wendy and the Twin Peaks Transmedia Experience, Enter the Lodge.
All right. Thanks. Hey, everyone. Yeah, my name is Emmett Fury. I am a writer and transmedia producer based out of Los Angeles. As far as transmedia goes, my niche is what I call social media storytelling. It usually involves me playing a bunch of fictional characters on Twitter in real time as certain web series play out. So what I'm going to do today is give you a real brief overview of the types of projects like this that I've done, and then get into sort of the nuts and bolts of how I did that, and if you all wanted to try to do something similar. So the first sort of foray of mine into this was a web series called Fury of Solace. It was a sort of a transmedia supervillain project, and it basically used real-time YouTube videos, interactive character Twitter accounts, extensive in-world blog content, and alternate reality game content. In-world basically just means in the story world. If the characters can see it, then it's in-world, essentially. And yeah, so, you know, you might watch a video and then do an interactive sort of a Twitter conversation, see a blog, go another video, do the online comic. The trans in transmedia for me is essentially refers to the trajectory of a person's walk through the story. Like they go from one media to another and back again. One thing that's, it lives at furyofsolace.com if you guys want to check out that. Last year, my brother and I did a project called Enter the Lodge. It was a about 5 or 6 months before they announced that Twin Peaks was actually coming back to television. We did our sort of own version of our third season entirely on Twitter, unauthorized completely. It was about 4 weeks real time, had more than 70 different character accounts and more than sort of 5,000 tweets all told. You can imagine if all of a sudden, like, all of the characters from Twin Peaks suddenly appeared on Twitter and started tweeting original content at each other and checking in on Foursquare to fictional locations in the fictional town of Twin Peaks, Washington. That's essentially what we did with that. One thing I want to point out for these, the one thing that seems to be in common with all of this kind of storytelling is that it's in real time. And not only is it in real time, but this is really the first time in entertainment history where there has been real-time serialized storytelling. It just wasn't possible before this technology made itself available. And so that lives at enterthelodge.com. And then most recently, I am the transmedia producer for this web series called The New Adventures of Peter and Wendy. It's a modern update of Dan Barry's Peter Pan. It takes a couple minutes, but I'm going to play you guys a video. We won Best Transmedia Experience for the International Academy Web Television Awards 2015 for the first season of this, and this was the four-year consideration video that we created, and I think it's a pretty good encapsulation of what the transmedia for this project is, so I'll give that a whirl here. Okay, so, oh, thanks. Like I said, mentioned earlier, in-world content, that refers to, like, this is the website for the sort of hometown paper, and we use it as sort of the hub of a lot of the transmedia elements. That's at KensingtonChronicle.com, the name of the local paper. The show lives on YouTube, but also at NewPeterAndWendy.com. Out-of-world content, of course, is ironically stuff in the real world where you're promoting the show. You know, it goes one way but not the other. Obviously, the characters never acknowledge that they're in a show, but the show can refer to the transmedia stuff. Now, when you're doing something like this, you got to pick what platforms you want to use. I have primarily used Twitter, so most of my examples will be about that. I have never use Facebook, only because what they put in this EdgeRank thing where you only see, there's this algorithm that determines whether you see posts based on how many likes it's gotten, essentially. You can't really guarantee that your content's being seen. You can change your own settings so you see everybody else's stuff, but you can't change all of their settings to make sure that they see what you're doing. So Twitter's been better for me as far as that. It's also kind of important if you have a target audience to figure out where they sort of naturally congregate. But at the same time, just like any kind of storytelling and any sort of platform, you should pick something that is good to tell the story that you're telling. So also when you start, you got to figure out what kind you want to tell, and the different kinds of social media stories really just have come down to the level of what kind of interactivity do you want. Into the Lodge that I talked about wasn't interactive in particular. It we were basically just using Twitter as a medium to tell the story. So like about 25 years ago, Twin Peaks was canceled after its second season with a whole bunch of cliffhangers left. And so we picked up our story in 1989 when the series left off. So we weren't actually pretending that the Twitter accounts in this case were Twitter accounts. It was more like we wrote a big script, and every time a character would have a line, it would be delivered via the Twitter account. And people just sort of instinctively knew that it was just a voyeuristic thing they were supposed to watch. It actually wound up being good because it was just my brother and I, and it would have required a small army to do 70 different interactive accounts. The next level is the other project talked about, interactive social media story where the audience can interact with characters on social media as themselves. That alternate reality game content, it was mentioned earlier in one of the videos, essentially, like, there's sort of built-in points where the audience can, as themselves, sort of interact and advance the story. And then the third level, what we were talking about in this video, is the fan role play. This has been the most interesting for me. It's sort of truly become an act of co-creation. I learned, our second season just ended, I learned that the fans have like Google Hangouts where they discuss each other's character storylines over the course of the release of our season. And I mean, that's just a microcosm of what it is that we do. So it's, you know, this is really about nuts and bolts of how to do it, but I'm happy to talk about some of the amazing sort of organic story things that came out of the fact that we gave so much agency to the fans to play in this sandbox that we made. So if you're doing this, you need to create all the sort of character accounts. You need a unique email address for each account, which means if you're doing a lot of characters, you're going to need a lot of emails. That's the 50 of the Twin Peaks characters. Now, I have an asterisk there because I haven't done this, but I talked to some other people who have. A Gmail has an alias system where you can set up, like, it's really all one email, but you just add another character, and I've been told that that can save you a lot of time on sort of email creation. Now, interesting is that every new... it wasn't always the case, but every new Twitter account is reviewed by a moderator, and if you do something that seems suspect, you might get your account suspended. And honestly, it's more because they're looking for spammers than anything else. What happens is whatever your Twitter handle was gets sort of in limbo until such time as if you were to like appeal the sort of suspension. I was always a little wary because, I wasn't sure how supportive they would be. But actually, they're pretty, as far as fiction, using it as a platform for fiction, Twitter's pretty good. Interestingly, for the fan roleplay stuff, if you put roleplay account or RP account in parentheses, like if you tell your fans to do that, Twitter usually is kind of okay with it. They kind of leave it alone. And basically, once they approve an account, they don't really look at it again. So I had to become like a better spammer. Like I had to make an unrelated account that looked real and then just sort of delete everything and, go back. Fortunately, most of those Twin Peaks accounts I created before this was an issue. Now, There are ways, of course, to schedule tweets so that you don't, or posts, so that you don't do it, have to do it in real time. In Twin Peaks, that was our project that was required. There was no way we were going to be able to do it real time. So that saves you some time, but what you don't have is you can't really schedule a tweet that's a response to a tweet that doesn't exist yet. So you don't have threading, and you can't really adjust on the fly to sort of fan interaction, although in this case the project wasn't interactive, so that really didn't matter. I will warn, third-party apps, if you have too many sort of at mentions, they sometimes will bounce back some of your posts at random, and when we learned that during during this, we kind of had to recalibrate how we approached it. But we were sending them out at kind of quite a clip, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. So, you know, it's from outside, it's easy to forget that essentially it's me tweeting at myself all day. Sometimes you kind of have to wear all hats on this stuff. But, you know, there's better ways than just sort of like logging out and then logging back into another character account. Obviously, there are platforms that manage this, like Hootsuite. I'm just mentioning, there's a lot. I'm going to mention the two that I have used. When you sign up for the pro account, it lets you manage up to 50 different accounts. And it's very easy as far as if you want to have the characters talk to each other or respond to the fans in real time, it's great for that. What we had problem with, it caps out at 50, which sounds like that should be enough. I mean, you can pay more to get additional. And you can only schedule posts every 5 minutes, which also seems reasonable, except, again, because we wrote Enter the Lodge like a screenplay, there were some scenes that had like 60 lines. So if they came out every 5 minutes, that would be an entire day. So I used a much sort of lesser known platform called Social Oomph. It lets you have unlimited accounts. Lets you schedule tweets once a minute, which is what we did. On the other hand, it's not as good at what Hootsuite is doing about being able to interact on that level directly. So the best way that people could experience this stuff is in real time. But, you know, sometimes people don't find it until after. This has been an interesting process. Alternate reality games, historically, and even some of these early sort of transmedia projects like this, have been historically sort of very ephemeral, in that if you weren't there, sometimes there isn't really an archive of the experience. And I think it's really important to have one. And I mean, not just because, not just for people who come later, but also we know that when you have, say, a video series, there's a smaller sort of percentage of your overall audience who is going to engage on this level, and if you need to convey content that occurred in that sort of part of the story, you need a way to give that to them. When I started with Fury of Solace, this site didn't exist. To do this, I basically hit favorite on a bunch of tweets and then hit print screen a bunch of times. I went into Photoshop and like put some stuff together. Storify now is a great site for this. It lets you drag and drop posts into a timeline. And when you click on one, it takes you back to the actual original post, and you can just embed the Storify on your own site or whatever. For Enter the Lodge, we have a separate Storify for every scene, and we were sort of assembling them on a daily basis as the content was being released and putting it up so that people could read it there, and it exists to this day if anyone wants to go check it out. So there's sort of a relatively nascent field of narratological study called cognitive narratology. It essentially says that we are only now starting to know enough about how the brain works to describe narrative in terms of the way we cognitively experience it. And, you know, as was mentioned earlier in the first talk, that idea of pattern recognition and the way we do that. The question is, what happens when you take a nonfiction medium and use it to create fiction, and how does that relate to the brain? Well, the examples I give when I'm talking more about the theory and history of this stuff is you look at, like, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast or found footage horror, And, you know, so for War of the Worlds, what, you know, we know that it's sort of, I'm sure you all know, but he took H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds sci-fi novel about alien invasion and did it as a radio play in the form of a radio news broadcast. It was like an hour-long program without commercials. They had a thing up front that said, this is fictional, but they didn't have another sort of break-in until about 40 minutes in, so if you missed the beginning. We know in retrospect it was not as... there wasn't mass hysteria. It's not as, you know, the media had a field day, and Orson Welles, it was of value to him and the network to say after the fact that it was a lot more impactful than it was. But the important issue here is that it's less how many people were fooled, but that anyone was at all. And to the extent that anyone was, it was because of the form it took and not even the content, which has to do with, essentially, most of them had not heard a radio news broadcast used for fiction. And because the brain automatically builds these connections between like things, when it hears, when they tuned in late and heard this news broadcast, they knew that every other news broadcast they heard was factual, so they were momentarily, at least, willing to believe that this was. Similarly, you know, found footage horror, which subverts the documentary method in the same way, is, you know, the fact that one is, that's a whole new subgenre of horror, and the fact that a film is found footage doesn't necessarily mean that it's a better film, but still, when I occasionally see them, it can be seem a little more real and a little scarier at times, just because our brain automatically makes the connection between the sort of nonfiction form that it's using and this. So, and then, of course, to explore it in what I do, the process by, you know, no one at any point believed that they're interacting with Peter Pan, you know. They knew it was fictional from the beginning, but the process by which they interact with the characters is the same process by which they interact with their real fans, and it occurs on the same platform amidst the other sort of conversations that they're having with real people. And again, because of how brain works, there's no way for them to not sort of equate the two and be more willing to suspend their disbelief as far as that goes. So I raced through it. So basically, I got a blog on my website. It goes into real detail about the projects that I've done, and a lot of the cognitive narratological research that I'm talking about will probably first appear there, hopefully sometime in the next coming year. So you can check that out. And this is where you can find me if you want to talk to me about this stuff. And of course, you can also talk to me about it here. And I'm happy to answer questions now, too, if anybody has any. Yes?
Why Peter Pan? I mean, what was the process of let's do effectively like rom-com from Twin Peaks and Supervillains?
See, that was the first project where I was I'm just the transmedia producer, so like I didn't create the show, but I work in close with the writer and the producers as far as the content, and it's a big collaborative process. But yeah, no, it's not only is it a different sort of genre than I usually work in, but I also gather our audience is something like 90% women, which is cool, and not the usual fan base that I have on the other projects. So part of the reason I decided to do it was to stretch those muscles that I hadn't really used. Sure.
May I kind of add to that? Do you have any sense of whether the people who engaged with the show were fans of the books or the stories as children?
I mean, I'm sure some were. I don't know the demographics on that exactly. Of course, it is, I guess, public domain, which is what allows us to do it. There has sort of been a whole movement of sort of indie classic lit YouTube adaptations in this sort of vlog style, and some of which have this sort of transmedia elements. Yeah.
I was just wondering about the engagement of people, right? Because it seems that any kind of interactive storytelling asks a lot from their fans, like to understand. So do you have any comments on that point? It's like if there is a minimum amount of engagement that somebody has to have to enter, and if that is... like the new average?
Well, I mean, yeah, it speaks to what I sort of briefly glossed over, the idea that, as a smaller percentage of your overall audience will engage at that maximum level of to that level. And you certainly don't have to. You can just watch the videos if you want, and we, you know, so we sort of collect the relevant social media story stuff so that we can present it to people who are not inclined to engage in that way or not particularly savvy with the tech. Some people still just want their kind of lean back experience where they're told what to watch and to watch it. But there's the aspects of this. The role play stuff. It's really interesting as far as empathy, like we've been talking about today. You know, when characters are having a hard time, people very sweetly kind of talk them through it, and it kind of encourages creativity with the stuff that they create and they just love. I mean, now on our level, we're so indie that there isn't any legal issue. Like if we take something that the fan created and sort of incorporated or mention it in our project, they're just happy to be acknowledged. But it's been there, but they are so happy to do it. And it's enriched the story overall in so many really cool ways.
Hello. So, okay, what was the biggest surprise? So you went in as transmedia producer before it rolled out, and you've mapped out where, like, your touch points were and what was going to happen. And, of course, once it starts rolling and the fans get in there and they don't always do what you think they're going to do, so clearly you were listening to them, but what was the biggest surprise for you? That were happening that you hadn't
answered. Sure.
You had to change?
How much time do we have? Oh, okay. Then I'll tell the story. 9 minutes. So we've got, so you saw in the video, fairies exist in this world. It's present day, but it's got some sort of magical elements. So one of the fan role players was a fairy, called herself Saw Blue. Now, our version of John Darling is sort of OCD about a lot of things, like OCD about cleaning. And so at one point, this character, Saw Blue, tweeted to him, "Hey, John, you want to come over and help me clean my apartment?" And as the character, I was like, that sounds like something he would do. So I'm like, all right. So again, all virtually role-played, he goes over there and he starts to, like, whatever, they're role-playing cleaning. And she starts to hit on him, like, real, real hard. And I was like, She's like, "We should go to see a movie." Again, this would be virtually played. And I was like, We can go see a movie, but, you know, I'm real busy with my job at the newspaper, so it can't be a date. It would just be a movie." And she was like, okay. So I'm like, all right, I guess I got to role play this on another day. And the thing is, you guys are familiar with the concept of shipping. It's a thing where fans want two fictional characters in a thing that they watch to be in a relationship. Some of the fan role players really wanted John to be in a relationship with this fan character. And
did you know the fan character? Did you know who it was behind?
No, I have no idea who she is, or if it even is a she. Yeah. So what was in the future referred to as John and Saw Blue's undate when they go to this movie, some of the other fan role players sort of, again, virtually followed around in, like, coats and hats, and were sort of like, from a, you know, discreet distance, trying to encourage something to happen that was never going to happen. But what was also interesting was we learn in season two that just finished that John is, the character is gay, and a thing that I did, because the actor who plays him, Grant Kurtz, is also gay, and I spoke to him about this because I wanted to be real circumspect in the way I approached this. But he said he'd had some discussion with girls where he would say, "Look, I mean, it's literally not you, it's me, or because I am not into women, and that's not going to happen." So I had, there was a sort of a direct message back and forth with this character, just a private thing that only she could see. If anything, in the second season, I got even more personal to reward sort of the fans who engaged this way. And it was just sort of like, "Look, I consider you a real friend, and I'm aware of your interest last time, and I was, when we went out, and I was trying to figure some things out at the time, but, you know, I just wanted to tell you that in case you would want," and, you know, she was very supportive and it was sweet. But so that's sort of a little saga. It's one of my favorite stories of, like, you know, I certainly wouldn't have planned this storyline. you know, it's you know, and again, they're actually, the fans are way more prolific than me. Like, they tweet way more than I do. It's fun.